Today on Building the Open Metaverse.
On the one hand, we all share that excitement over what these systems can do. On the other hand, we're committed to the idea that that none of this works unless creators can get credit and money for their contributions.
Welcome to Building the Open Metaverse, where technology experts discuss how the community is building the open metaverse together. Hosted by Patrick Cozy from Cesium and Mark Petit from Epic Games.
Hello everyone and welcome to our show, Building the Open Metaverse, the podcast where technologists share their insight on how the community is building the open metaverse together. My name is Mark Petit from Epic Games and my co-host is Patrick Cozy from Cesium. Patrick, how are you today?
Hi, Mark. Well, we have a fantastic guest, so I'm doing amazing.
Yeah, no, I think you're as excited as me to welcome Neil Stephenson to the show. As many of you know, Neil coined the term metaverse in his book Snow Crash, which was published back in 1992. Neil, it was great to have you speak at our panel at SIGGRAPH, and we really wanted to share your insight and vision with our audience, so welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. I really enjoyed the experience at SIGGRAPH, and so I'm looking forward to talking about this stuff more with you guys today.
Thanks, Neil. So you have a really fascinating background, and could we start off by you sharing, you know, what led to your interest in computer graphics, and what was happening in the industry in the early 90s that ultimately led you to write Snow Crash?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been programming computers since I was 14 years old in one way or another, and I was always interested in graphics, so I got a Mac as soon as they were available. In 1988, I started a graphic novel project with an artist friend of mine named Tony Sheeter, and we, to make a long story short, the project didn't really go anywhere commercially, but we wanted to use computer graphics to generate some of the imagery, and I ended up doing a lot of work in 1988, 89, 90, programming a Mac 2, souped up with some transputer boards to do image processing. And as part of that, I went to SIGGRAPH in 1990. And got exposed to a lot of what was happening in the space then. So the conclusion I came to was that computer graphics was right on the threshold of becoming just a fascinating new communications medium. Even though what we had then was primitive compared to what we have now, you could see how it was going to develop. You could see that, for example, with RenderMan, it was possible to write a few lines of code that would generate a three-dimensional rendering or a two-dimensional rendering of a three-dimensional scene. And there were a lot of other early precursors there that it didn't take a lot of insight to see that it was all going to add up to a new medium. And the only question in my mind was, how can we make it cheap and ubiquitous? Because I had spent a lot of money buying equipment and it was hard to use. And I had to write all the code myself. And so I was asking myself, if you look at television, for example, in the 30s, it was similarly kind of a primitive, expensive laboratory curiosity. But a couple of decades later, televisions were ubiquitous appliance in people's homes. And how did that transformation happen? Well, it happened because there was programming that people wanted to enjoy. And so because of, I Love Lucy and the Ed Sullivan Show and other programs like that, millions of people went out and bought these things. The cost of producing them went down, the level of quality went up, we got color TV, we got bigger screens. So the question was, what could trigger a similar transformation that would make computer graphics into a ubiquitous medium? And my guess at the time was this idea of the metaverse. And since the graphic novel project had come to an end by that point, I just sat down and wrote a new book, Snow Crash, in which the metaverse obviously plays a central role.
Yeah, it was interesting to know that you thought about that before a game like Doom even existed. I mean, there was a lot of foresight right there.
Yeah, Doom came out the year after Snow Crash was published, and it shocked me in a good way that because I had done enough playing around with rendering to know that Carmack, you know, and company had achieved something incredible by making the hardware of that era actually render convincing three-dimensional graphics. I wouldn't have thought it was possible in 1993.
So at SIGGRAPH, you know, you mentioned that, you know, the key to bringing billions of people into the metaverse is to create engaging experiences. And you said something interesting, and I quote you there. So you said, the basic problem to be solved is, you know, creative industries is how to get artists to make art in a coherent and coordinated way. And then you went on and talked about the tug of war between artists and the suits, you know, the investor, the executive, and that how it impacts the risk reward, you know, often at the expense of creativity. I thought it was a fascinating topic about the re-enablement of the creative. So how do we achieve that?
So, yeah, like as you'll understand, given your position at Epic, these experiences that we call video games are huge collaborations. I mean, there's indie games. There's even some games that, you know, that are made by one individual who does everything. But a lot of games involve hundreds or more of collaborators with different areas of specialization. You'll have texture artists, you'll have animators, sound people, music writers. Just like in making a movie, all of those people have to work together in a coherent way. And they have to get paid. So we have a system for doing that in the film industry, and it works. I mean, we have movies, but it's unwieldy and it's expensive. It requires financing. I mean, you need to find investors who are willing to place bets on projects that might take years to get finished, and then you know, it's what they call hit-based investing. I mean, the project, regardless of how successful it is creatively, it might be a huge hit at the box office, or it might completely fail, and nobody knows why. You know, nobody can completely predict it. You have to invest in a lot of movies, then spread the risk out over a lot of projects. So how do we solve the financing problem for games and for metaverse experiences? The old system in Hollywood. I should say I'm in Hollywood now. I'm in Beverly Hills at the Code conference, so you can see the palm trees, you know, and the Beverly Hills, you know, rising up above me. In the old system, you've got studio executives who have tried to read the tea leaves and look at the financial, the box office numbers and figure out what movies are people going to want to watch next year. We'll invest our money in that, and that's because the data stream is a very thin one. It's the signal is very weak. Basically, moviegoers either go to the theater and buy a ticket or they don't. and you aggregate all of that data and you look at it, and you try to figure out, try to make decisions as to where to put your money. It seems that in the internet, we now have much richer streams of data coming back from the users. Games used to be installed and just played on they could be played on a computer that wasn't even connected to the internet, but now everything's on the internet and you can instrument your games, the code in your games, and people, all companies do now instrument their games. So they know exactly which features are interesting to players, and what succeeds and what fails. So it seems as though it ought to be possible to kind of cut the studio executives out of the decision loop and try to figure out a way to directly monetize those aspects of an online experience that the players most enjoy.
It feels, at least 6 months to a year ago, that NFTs and the ability for creators to sell their art directly to consumer onto novel platform would be a very promising avenue. And some artists made a lot of money through the transition. So today, I think I was reading this morning that the volume of NFTs is down 99% on OpenSea.
It's down 99%. Wow.
But still, the creators need new platforms. And as you say, being at the mercy of studio executives, there is a promise in the metaverse and the creator economy of a direct, transaction driven process that should be valuable for the artists, for the creators. Do you believe in that?
Well, it seems as though it should be possible in principle, right? And so that's kind of where we are today. The NFTs, I think, were the first stab at this. And there's a lot. If you look at the way that those contracts are structured and, what's actually being bought and sold, it's a very primitive process today. So, I've bought a couple of pieces of NFT art and, the whole process of setting up a wallet and doing the transaction and then looking at the NFT after you've bought it is incredibly cumbersome. And there's kind of some stress involved in it. Like there, you read all the time about various hacks and various, data breaches and so on that happen in this world. And no one likes to be sitting there worrying, about, are hackers draining my bank account, because I didn't patch my software at the right time or because I clicked on the wrong link. So I think we're in the very, very early days of the NFT market. But it is definitely the case that there are artists who are succeeding at this, and they're not just making kind of junk. There are legitimate artists making completely worthwhile pieces of art and selling them into this market. I'm hoping that things will kind of resolve themselves and settle out, over the next year or so.
So switching gears a little bit, let's talk about AI. I mean, thinking back to the Open Metaverse course at SIGGRAPH, AI art was repeatedly mentioned. And for someone like me who doesn't have any artistic skill, the idea of doing natural language and then having that generate an image or a model, is very appealing. And then for, more advanced content creators, using AI to, help with Regan, it seems like a very exciting direction. Neil, I'm curious, how do you think AI will impact creators and their creator economy?
We've been talking about this a lot lately inside of the startup I co-founded, Lamina One, because you know, a lot of what it's a little bit of a mixed picture, because on the one hand, we all share that excitement over what these systems can do. On the other hand, we're committed to the idea that that none of this works unless creators can get credit and money for their contributions. And one of the observations that's been made about these systems is that if I say I want a picture of a palm tree in the style of Leonardo da Vinci, the system is going to go and find a bunch of old Leonardo da Vinci images, and it's going to use those to create that image. But if I say that I want that in the style of a living artist, then the system's going to do the same thing by drawing upon the imagery that it can find of work that that artist has performed. And at that point, there's some serious ethical considerations that come into play. Like, shouldn't a living artist or the estate of an artist get fairly compensated if their work is going to be used in that way? My co-founder Peter Vesinus has actually got a paper in the works where he instrumented some of this code to actually keep track of the degree of influence that different inputs had on the final result, and it actually works. So I'm hoping he'll publish that on our site pretty soon. But the basic finding, which I'm sure could be duplicated by other people if they wanted to try this, is that if you understand how this code works, how it generates these results, you can actually track the degree of influence that any given image or any given input had on the final result. And then if that final result is worth something, then maybe there's a way to give credit and some compensation in proportion to those inputs.
I think if we just had, like, you know, tracking secondary sales so that artists can benefit from secondary sales, it would be already a great step forward.
Right, which is a feature that you can build in, as you know, you can build that into a smart contract, and many NFT artists kind of rely on that as a long tail of possible revenue.
That would be such a huge progress. So let's talk a little bit about Lamina One. Just for the record, you wrote Cryptonomicon. It was explicitly about cryptocurrency. When was that?
1999. So it was pre blockchain.
So you must have thought a lot about those cryptocurrencies, and, you know, where we are today. There's a lot of negative opinions about crypto, even some hostility. So what is your take on that, and how do we turn the tide around? Because there seems to be value in the concept behind crypto. We just discussed, you know, the value for creators. And so how do we turn the tide here?
Yeah, there's definitely value. I mean, I think Bitcoin prior to the crash was something like $1 trillion of valuation. So I think of it in terms of signal to noise ratio. So the signal is what is a currency actually worth, and the noise is what's the uncertainty around it. So in with a traditional fiat currency like dollars or euros, people use those all the time to buy potatoes, gasoline, steel. And so that's a very strong signal that tells you what that currency is worth. And some people speculate on currencies, on traditional currencies, and that might introduce a little bit of noise, but still the signal to noise ratio is very strong. in the case of a lot of cryptocurrencies, a great deal of the traffic, of the transactions that happen are speculative in nature. And there's not much, these currencies sometimes aren't used that much for normal economic transactions. So it's hard to know what they're worth. The signal to noise ratio is really bad. And the result is volatility, and so volatility adds to more volatility as people become nervous about the true value of these things. So I think that the way to get a strong signal and to establish the stable value of such a currency is by actually using it for economic transactions. And in the gaming industry, we've got, I think, a model for that, because a game is it's just bits, right? I mean, 20 years ago, maybe a game would ship on a DVD-ROM or a cartridge. Those were just ways of moving bits around. The real game is bits, and yeah, we know that those bits have got a reasonably stable economic value. Or if you go to the Epic Store or the Steam Store, there are prices there for not only for whole games but for components of games. You know, asset stores and so on, or add-on packs, UGC, and prices there fluctuate, but still they don't fluctuate that much. So I think we can say that in the economy of the game industry, there is such a thing as sort of a fairly stable price, fairly stable economic value of these digital assets. And so what we're intending to do with Lamina One is create a new layer one currency that is intended for and kind of optimized for those kinds of transactions. We hope to see it. We're not going to do an initial coin offering or anything like that that feels speculative in nature. We're going to instead try to get creators using this as a way to do business, and we want to see it being used as a common currency that will have value, not because people are speculating on it, but because people are using it to buy and sell digital goods.
Well, that focus on, for Lamina One to focus on art and creators and digital goods, I think is fascinating. And I wish you success, because I think we Roger need that. You know, on our station, we tried to introduce NFTs at the wrong time. It did not quite work out, but we do see pent-up demand for a tool, a solution for artists and creators. So we wish you luck with Lamina One. So can you speak to some of the most difficult challenges of blockchain, and who's trying to solve them? You mentioned in your SIGGRAPH address, some companies like Bcopy and... can you come back on some of those, core challenges that are top of mind for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I should say that although I'm a reasonably technical guy, I'm not an expert on blockchains and cryptocurrencies. It's a thing I've followed at arm's length for a long time, but I've always found it a challenging thing to fully understand, and I like to leave it to experts, because if you make a mistake and do it wrong, the consequences can be bad. So for any kind of detailed technical conversation about the chain and crypto, I'd get you in touch with Peter, who can speak to that. But coming at it from kind of my end of things, which, you know, has to do with the creator economy and so on, there's a there's a concept that that Jaron Lanier has talked about, probably others as well, but I know Jaron, so I think of it as a Jaron thing, which is the idea of a value chain. I'll give you an example. Let's say that I were to write a book that had a magic sword that was just described in the book. Well, maybe I'd like to see that used in a game or a metaverse experience. I could put something on a blockchain describing the sword, and maybe have a little sketch that I draw on a envelope, and some words of description. And that's enough for me to say, I created this idea on such and such day. But that's a far cry from being an asset that could actually be used in an experience. Somebody might then come along and take that and create an asset that could be sold on the Unreal Asset Store or the Unity Asset Store, that a game maker could buy and drag into their game. But even that isn't yet a fully usable integrated asset, because just having it in a folder in the game directory doesn't create a good experience. You probably want your art director to make a pass over it and make the appearance of the sword consistent with the overall art, you know, direction of the game. You've got sound designers who need to do something similar with the sounds that it makes when it's used. And you've got programmers who need to, using blueprints or C++, who need to integrate the sword into the game so that it actually is capable of doing something and contributing to the experience. So at each stage, more value is being added. And at the end of that process, you've got something that might actually bring in some revenue. And when that revenue finally appears, what you'd like it to do is propagate backwards. You'd like the different people who contributed to the value chain to get compensated in some way. So the question in front of us is how to set that up. And in Hollywood, there's an idea called a waterfall, you know, which is how does money flow down to the different people involved in a project. It works, but it's cumbersome and expensive. We've been working with a company called Neon Machine in Seattle, which is working on a game called Shrapnel that's going to be a blockchain NFT game. And they've been developing some ideas for new kinds of smart contracts that would solve some of the problems I've just been describing. And it's not only a matter of sending money back up the value chain, but there's also ways to build in permissions. So as the original creator of the idea, I might not approve of all of the ways in which it gets adapted. You know, some troll might take it and use it to make something that I find objectionable, or just bend it out of past all recognition. And so at that point, I'd like to be able to say, I withdraw my approval for this. You know, I don't consider this to be a legitimate use of my work. So these are all, I think, advances in how smart contracts work and how NFTs work that we can look forward to in coming months and years. And I'm hoping that it'll it's not going to be easy, but I think it's doable. And if we can get some people using these ideas and adopting these contract templates, then I think we'll have contributed something to the open metaverse.
Absolutely. I think I remember you mentioned, the problem of having legal binding agreement for things that are on-chain and assets, either virtual or physical, they don't reside on the chain, and trying to find a legal framework to solve those problems. I think we have a lot of those issues ahead of us.
I'm working with Josh Kramer at BKOPY. The BKOPY is the name of a project he's been working on to address some of these issues. He's a guy who's been programming since he was very young, but he was had a high-ranking position at Amazon Studios for a while, so he knows a lot about the world of IP rights and contracts and how that all works. So. He's been looking at the state of NFT agreements as they exist today, and it's very primitive and needs a lot of work. So his system is going to involve placing an agreement, a binding legal agreement, on chain, and then you can make pointers back to that. Agreement. Maybe I should explain that one of the issues with blockchains is that they're expensive, almost kind of shockingly expensive places to store data. We're used to being able to store huge documents on, Google Drive or whatever, for almost no, almost for free. But storing data on the blockchain is much more expensive than that. So you can't, if you've created a image or a movie that's, a megabyte or even gigabytes, in general, putting that whole thing on a blockchain is prohibitively expensive. And so what tends to happen in NFT transactions is that the thing on the chain is only a pointer to the thing itself, but that then gets into a bunch of issues around the permanence and the stability of the thing that's pointed to.
Fascinating. I think Lamina One has its work cut out for it. So many problems. Kind of glad that we're going through a bit of a crypto winter, shaking out the speculation, and hopefully the good actors remain, and we can build up, a stack that's actually useful for the creators.
I hope that in a couple of years we'll look back on it and be glad that we launched when we did, which was really at the absolute bottom of the market. No one can accuse us of surfing on the a wave of unhinged speculation.
Does Lamina One have a view on the environmental concern around the amount of compute necessary to run crypto?
You guys probably know this, but for people in the audience who don't, the first blockchain, layer one blockchain, was Bitcoin, which relies on an idea called proof of work. So the way that with any currency, the issue is, how do you prove that it's not counterfeit? And there's a way to do that by basically solving big math problems. It's called proof of work. And it it works, but as Bitcoin has become a very large industry, solving those math problems has ended up consuming an unbelievable amount of energy. And so there's a lot of concern about that for very good reasons. There are other ways to back a currency. Proof of stake is one that consumes orders of magnitude less energy. And so Ethereum, for example, has started out as proof of work, but any day now they're going to switch over to a proof of stake system that's going to be much more environmentally benign. We're going to use, of course, we're going to use a proof of stake system that, you know, is as efficient as we can make it. It still is going to consume some energy, and we would prefer not to have any carbon footprint at all, or even be carbon negative, meaning that as this system is used, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere actually goes down. We're going to build that in. One of the advantages of starting a layer one chain is that it gives you the freedom to make engineering decisions. And one of those decisions is going to be that in order to operate a node, which is the kind of the thing that consumes the energy on the network, you need to be able to prove that you purchased carbon credits from a legitimate supplier. Not all carbon credits are created equal, so there's a whole additional layer of complexity around figuring out which ones of those are worth buying. But we want to build that in, and we're even looking at some more ambitious ideas on the carbon side of things that are currently too crazy to talk about. So they'll be in a separate lane.
Neil, I appreciate your concerns around the environment there. We wanted to do a couple of topics around your thoughts on the future. So earlier in the podcast, you know, you mentioned that you're impressed with Doom and the graphics that was being done there in the early 90s. And since then, really the gaming industry has helped drive the decline in the cost for GPUs and graphics. We're curious, you know, what do you think the most disruptive industry will be moving forward?
You know, in a lot of ways, I've gotten out of the future predicting game because the future is coming too fast. When I was working on Fall or Dodge in Hell, my second to the most recent novel, I wrote a whole bit about social media that I thought was very futuristic. And, you know, here's Neil being the great predictor of the future. And then when Trump got elected, I just had to tear it all out and redo it, because what had really happened was so much crazier than what I had written that I had to redo the work. Boy, disruptive stuff now is I'm very interested in what's happening with big traditional infrastructure heavy industries around energy, particularly. I think that cost of photovoltaics has been just plummeting steadily year after year. And it's one of these things that we don't necessarily notice the change from day to day, but suddenly if you look at a graph of what's happened in that market, it's a huge change. And I think that we're kind of approaching a crossroads where a lot of our thought habits, a lot of our instincts around the environment and energy are going to be challenged, because we're used to thinking that it's always good to conserve energy. You should turn off the light, you know, in the room that you're not using. You should never waste anything, because we sort of assume that all energy production is bad, that it's we act as though it's all coming from a coal-fired power plant somewhere. And in some places it is. So if you live in one of those areas, you should definitely try to conserve electricity. But in a lot of places, it's coming from clean sources now, and a lot more is going to have to happen for us to get out of the mess that we're in. So I think what we're going to see in the next few decades is huge amounts of photovoltaic capacity coming online. We're going to see nukes are making a comeback, and wind turbines are going up all over the place. I was in Iowa a couple of weeks ago, and there's just huge fields of wind turbines going off to the horizon. And when you're generating power using those kinds of technologies, it's okay to use energy. There's nothing wrong with it. And if you're using the energy to have a beneficial effect to withdraw carbon from the atmosphere, let's say, then it's good. But it goes against a lot of the environmental dogma that we were all brought up to believe in.
Yeah, Neil, you gave me a flashback when I was a kid growing up. I used to get grounded if I left the lights on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so it's partly just the... the traditional, you should never, waste not, want not kind of mentality, but it's reinforced by the environmental argument as well. The mentality that says we should not build things is going to get in the way. It's already getting in the way. There was a whole controversy in New England about building some power lines that would bring hydroelectric power from Quebec down towards New York. By almost any measure, that is a good thing to do environmentally. But local groups, we're using environmental regulations from the 70s, to sort of block the building of those power lines. We're going to see more of those conflicts coming up.
So, Neil, if I could ask one more prediction-related question. So thinking, again, back to the Open Metaverse course at SIGGRAPH, we had a lot of fantastic speakers like yourself and also Rev from NVIDIA, and Rev leads Omniverse there. And he said something really interesting about, when our computing powers become powerful enough, we'll be able to do simulations that are calculating millions of scenarios, and then we'll be able to predict the future, right? So as someone who, I believe, Neil, that you predicted the future many times, how do you feel about this potential?
I mean, it just depends on how good the simulations are, I think... For any simulation where human decision making and human creativity is in the loop, that the reliability of those simulations is questionable. There's always something weird that happens. If there's other, if there's more mechanistic simulations, then maybe that could work. People use simulations all the time. There's a whole field of simulation, applied simulation theory called Monte Carlo simulation, where if you can't mechanistically predict something, you just run a bunch of an ensemble of simulations and do statistics on the output. I think the most important kinds of predictions that we would like to make have to do with humans and how humans behave, and as we've just seen politically in the last decade or so, you know, people are very hard to predict. I don't think many people would have predicted the invasion of Ukraine, but even ones who did predict it probably wouldn't have predicted that Ukraine would fight back as effectively as it has, using the kinds of clever ideas and adaptations that they've done. So I guess I'm skeptical.
So you were able to envision the metaverse back in 1992 when you told us, you know, you were exposed, you know, you bought computers in the very early stage, you came from a family of engineers and studied physics. So has these things led you to think about the worlds perhaps differently? So any advice for our younger listeners on what they should be focusing on and doing today?
This may be kind of an old man answer, but I more and more find value in reading history. I gave a commencement talk at Berkeley's School of Computer Science back in May. I just think that it's very rare for things to happen today that are unprecedented. If you don't study history, then you're always surprised. And it's easy to think that whatever happens is unique.
That makes all the sense. Thank you, Neil. So it's time for our closing remarks. We usually close the podcast with the same two questions. The first question is, was there any topic you would have liked to discuss today that we did not discuss?
I mean, this might sound like special pleading, but I'm fascinated by what Epic's doing with Unreal Engine and what's happening in that ecosystem right now. The rise of virtual production and the bringing so many tools to bear. So that's something I follow as much as I have time for. But it would probably be getting us very deep into the weeds to talk about that in detail.
That could be a whole other episode. So, Neil, last but not least, my favorite question is, do you want to give any shout-outs to a person or an organization?
Yeah, that's one I probably should have prepared for because my mind always goes blank at times like this. I already mentioned Anne Applebaum. I think she's one of the most important writers who's contributing to our intellectual life today, both because of her historical writing and because of her writing about current events and the rise of authoritarianism and so on and so forth. So big endorsement for her. I don't know, maybe we should just leave it at that. As soon as we hang up, I'll think of 12 others that I should have mentioned. Yeah.
Well, Neil Stephenson, thank you very much for being with us today. We wish you best of luck with Lamina One. It looks like a fantastic project.
Thanks. Yeah. No, we have our work cut out for us, as you pointed out, but we're looking forward to most of that work.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to reread your novels, Cryptonomicon, Snow Crash, of course. I encourage everybody to dig into those books. They're quite amazing.
Thank you. Very much appreciated.
Patrick, it's time to say goodbye. So thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Neil. And we'll be back for a new episode next week. Thank you, everyone.